The multi-faith conference had several hundred participants, both Israeli and from abroad, Muslim, Christian, and Jewish. I always judge the success of a gathering by how many younger people show up and what sorts of conversations happen, you know, that are unscheduled.
After 17 years of breathing, I, Rick B. John Kostner, do hereby declare there sure as hell are a few people I could live without.
Like his cult classic, The Man Who Fell in Love with the Moon, Now Is the Hour is about finding yourself.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. London lesbians lose their bid for Canadian marriage recognition, queers brave the Mideast conflict to stand proud in Jerusalem, and how an award-winning gay novelist fled his closet. Those stories and more this week, because now is your half hour to discover This Way Out.
I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending August 12, 2006. Two British lesbians who demanded legal recognition in the UK of their Canadian marriage were turned down in the London High Court Family Division. UK law automatically converts foreign same-gender marriages into civil partnerships, which nonetheless provide all the same rights and obligations. Sue Wilkinson and Celia Kitzinger, who were legally married in Vancouver, British Columbia in 2003, denounced the court decision as profoundly discriminatory and an affront to social justice and human rights. The ruling, in part, said that Parliament has not called partnerships between persons of the same sex marriage, not because they are considered inferior to the institution of marriage, but because, as a matter of objective fact and common understanding, they are indeed different. The couple said they may appeal the ruling, though they're very concerned that the government is now seeking £25,000 from them, about $47,000, for the cost of the High Court case. They say that amount is roughly equivalent to their life savings.
A lesbian denied custody of her three children by Chile's Supreme Court has taken her case to the Organization of American States Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. The Chilean court ruled in 2004 that Karen Atala's lesbian life created for her daughters a situation of risk whose pernicious consequences would damage their psychic development and make them objects of social discrimination, according to a New York Times translation. Atala's lawyer, Macarena Sayas, told the Times that she will argue that due process was not respected. Atala's right to privacy was violated when courts had her computer searched looking for evidence of strange behavior, and the right of her children to be heard, which is binding in Chile, was completely set aside. If Atala wins, it will set precedent in several Latin American nations whose constitutions stipulate that rulings by the inter-American system override those of their own courts. Chilean activists believe the stage is set for progress on LGBT causes under new President Michelle Bachelet, a socialist, feminist, single mother, and former health minister who oversaw the country's HIV/AIDS programs.
An ugly custody battle in two U.S. states between lesbian former partners over a four-year-old girl named Isabel Miller Jenkins moved a step closer to the U.S. Supreme Court with a ruling last week by Vermont's highest court. Isabel was conceived through artificial insemination to Lisa Miller Jenkins. At the time, Lisa was in a relationship with Janet Miller Jenkins, which, as residents of Vermont, they formalized through a civil union. When the relationship between the two women soured and they split up, a judge in Vermont gave Janet Miller Jenkins temporary visitation rights with the child. Lisa then renounced her homosexuality and fled with her daughter to Virginia, which has some of the worst anti-queer legislation in the country. She went to court in that state seeking sole custody of the child. A Virginia judge ruled that since the mother now resided in his state, Lisa was the sole parent and that Janet is nothing more than a friend to the child. A family court judge in Vermont then found Lisa in contempt for moving to Virginia and disobeying a court order involving the child's joint custody, and another Vermont judge ruled in November that under the state's civil union law, Janet must be regarded as a co-parent. The August 4th Vermont High Court ruling determined that the civil union between Lisa and Janet was valid and that the family court had jurisdiction to dissolve the union. In a unanimous ruling, the justices also said that Vermont's family court had exclusive jurisdiction to issue the temporary custody and visitation order under a series of state laws, including the Parental Kidnapping Protection Act. Lisa Miller-Jenkins has not commented on the latest ruling, but she's expected to file an appeal with the U.S. Supreme Court.
A German court ruled this week that an Iranian lesbian can't be deported because she could face a death sentence in the Islamic nation. The 27-year-old woman, whose name was not released, traveled to Germany in September 2003 and applied for asylum. She was originally turned down by immigration officials, but appealed that decision, saying she wanted to live out her homosexuality openly without having to fear persecution. The Stuttgart Administrative Court ordered the government to grant her request for asylum, concluding that the chance of disproportionate or discriminatory punishment of a homosexual relationship between women is very high in Iran. Such a relationship is an absolute breaking of taboos, even worse than between men. The court also said its ruling is binding precedent for similar cases. According to Iranian human rights advocates, over 4,000 lesbians and gay men have been executed since the Ayatollahs came to power in 1979.
The gay and lesbian stall at Zimbabwe's International Book Fair in Harare has been trashed yet again. Gays and Lesbians of Zimbabwe, or GALS, was formed in 1990 and rose to prominence in 1995 when it challenged bans by the government on its participation at the annual book fair. The GALS stall has survived in the past few years, but it was vandalized again this week. Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe is unpopular for his economic policies, but his anti-queer rhetoric, at one time calling gays and lesbians worse than dogs and pigs, resonates with many of his countrymen. Mugabe most recently accused gay gangsters of being among the saboteurs conspiring for regime change.
Gays and lesbians in the U.S. military face continuing hostility on bases and ships where top brass fail to prohibit harassment. This more than 6 years after the Pentagon specifically prohibited anti-queer abuse, according to the findings of an investigation by the Reuters news service published this week. On the Navy's USS Theodore Roosevelt aircraft carrier, for example, anti-gay statements and jokes have been incorporated into a video about the F-14 Tomcat fighter aircraft, recently shown to reporters on the carrier. Pilots sported T-shirts that said, "I'm a Tomcat guy and you're a homo." The commander of the fighter squadron himself wore the shirt. Aaron Belkin of the Center for the Study of Sexual Minorities in the Military at the University of California, Santa Barbara, told Reuters that the line between that and threats and violence can be quite thin. In a 2000 memo to the armed services and commanders, the Pentagon said, "Mistreatment, harassment, and inappropriate comments or gestures based on sexual orientation were not acceptable." In response to questions from Reuters, Rear Admiral Denby Starling, commander of Naval Air Force U.S. Atlantic Fleet, said in an email that steps have been taken to ensure that the offending messages have been removed. Squadron and air wing leadership have been counseled regarding the inappropriate tone set by such messages and poor judgment demonstrated in allowing their display.
Two lesbi-gay 19-year-olds brought a national Right to Serve campaign to Charlottesville, Virginia, and were immediately rejected when they attempted to enlist in the U.S. military this week. Wyatt Four and Rachel Miller walked into the recruitment center at a local shopping center under a media spotlight. "My sexual orientation doesn't have anything to do with my ability to serve in the military," Ford told reporters, noting that he would like to have joined the Navy because his father and grandfather had both been sailors. "It's very difficult for straight people to understand what life in the closet is about," he added. The Right to Serve campaign has been organized by Soul Force, a non-denominational LGBT advocacy group. Earlier this month, three openly queer young people were turned away when they tried to enlist at an Army recruiting station in Philadelphia, and in May, a gay man and a lesbian were rejected when they tried to join the Minnesota National Guard. For the past 2 years, the U.S. military has been unable to meet its recruiting goals. According to the Government Accountability Office, more than 800 service members discharged for being gay or lesbian were trained in skills deemed mission critical by the Defense Department. In June, the Pentagon was forced to apologize when it was revealed that one of its documents listed homosexuality among various disorders, decades after mental health experts abandoned that position. A bipartisan coalition in the Republican-controlled Congress now supports legislation to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, but the measure has thus far gone nowhere.
And finally, The vehemently anti-queer Focus on the Family has been benched at Turner Field, home to the Atlanta Braves, after it co-sponsored the first Major League Baseball Faith Day there on July 27th, a promotional event designed to pack the ballpark with evangelical Christians. Focus on the Family representatives distributed anti-queer pamphlets to parents, teens, and clergy at the game, including a hot topic about how lesbi-gay activist groups are targeting public schools. In a column posted the next day on the website of The Nation, sports writer Dave Zirin wrote that the involvement of Focus on the Family represented the ugliest edge of right-wing evangelism and its advancing influence. Braves spokesperson Beth Marshall then told reporters that, "We do not feel it is an appropriate connection for Focus on the Family to be part of such events in the future."
But in an apparent first for U.S. Major League Sports, the Gay Men's Chorus of Washington performed the Star-Spangled Banner before a Washington Nationals baseball game this week at D.C.'s RFK Stadium. Their performance received a standing ovation. However, because the national anthem was being performed, the crowd in the stadium was probably already standing.
That's News Wrap for the week ending August 12th, 2006. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
A celebrated writer finds a novel way to tell his own coming out story later in the program. Considering the volatile situation in the Middle East, it had to have been nothing less than remarkable that the Jerusalem World Pride Festival came off without any major problems this week. A health fair, Women's Day, and LGBT Youth Day each drew several hundred participants. A multi-faith religious conference may have been something of a first, as lay people and clergy gathered at Hebrew Union College on August 9th for several plenary sessions, speeches, and unique dialogue.
Today was a huge success.
Rabbi Sharon Kleinbaum is from New York City's Congregation Beth Simchat Torah.
Given the complexities and difficulties of the situation here in Israel, we gathered together religious activists from around the world and hopefully presented a very different image of what religion and its role could be, and took a strong stand against the right-wing religious bigots who are using religion as a weapon against our lives.
We asked Rabbi Kleinbaum, who's also the World Pride North American co-chair, if there was any Palestinian participation.
No, Palestinians who are in the West Bank or Gaza could not come into Israel. And we went to the one of the checkpoints by Bethlehem to express our solidarity with our brothers and sisters in the territories who couldn't come.
Rabbi Ayala Cohen, also from Congregation Beth Simchat Torah, was among non-gay religious people at the multi-faith conference.
As a straight person who is a rabbi, I think it is imperative that we gather together both GLBT people who are deeply and profoundly religious people and straight people who are committed to working to make this world more just and to make religion reflect the values of tolerance and pluralism and really make clear that it is a place where GLBT people are creating vital transformation.
Rabbi Kleinbaum discussed the wide spectrum of religious belief represented at the conference.
The multi-faith conference had several hundred participants, both Israeli and from abroad.
We certainly had Muslim, Christian, and Jewish. We had a gay Catholic priest, evangelist, Methodist, gay Lutheran minister, pastor from Germany, a pastor from Sweden, UCC, MCC, Metropolitan Community Church, Unitarian, Unity Fellowship Church. And in terms of Jewish, we had Reform, Conservative, Reconstructionist, and Orthodox. I would say it was two-thirds from outside of Israel and one-third Israeli.
Irshad Manji is the controversial best-selling author of The Trouble with Islam Today, a Muslim's call for reform in her faith. She's also a visiting fellow in the International Security Studies program at Yale University.
You know, I always judge a gathering or the success of a gathering by two things. One is how many younger people show up, and because really, you know, they are the ones who are going to be carrying the message forward. And secondly, what sorts of conversations happen, you know, that are unscheduled. scheduled in the corridors, for example. And on both of those fronts, I have to say that this multi-faith conference has been a huge success. I've had some of the most delightful, wonderful encounters with younger, if I can put it this way, seminarians. I don't know that that's the right word for the particularly Jewish theology students, but those who are studying to become rabbis or who have a huge interest in the rising influence of religion in geopolitics today have just provided me with some wonderful insights of their own. And that's not something that you can necessarily schedule. Younger people approach me to say that as a result of what they had heard in my speech that night, they are seriously considering returning to the fold of Islam, because this was one of the few times that they had heard the statement about how Allah and gays can be reconciled. Those have really been the highlights for me, and I leave this conference feeling very optimistic about the future.
Noah Sata of Jerusalem Open House, the major organizers of the week's events, talked about the impact of current events on attendance.
Our estimate is that several hundred people came to World Pride from all over the world, from Europe, the U.S., Canada, and a few from South America. And fortunately, due to the war in Lebanon, we did have a lot of cancellations.
A much ballyhooed visit by LGBT youth to the Knesset, Israel's parliament, also came off without much of a hitch. Again, Noah Sata of Jerusalem Open House.
There were about 100 teenagers and young people who met with the Knesset Committee for Children's Welfare and representatives from the Ministry of Education and the Ministry of Health, the various issues concerning GLBT youth. And despite huge threats of demonstrations against this event, there were 7 people protesting it.
In the major culminating event of the 6-day World Pride Festival, a group of about 200 LGBT people and their supporters held a silent vigil in Jerusalem's Liberty Bell Park on the evening of August 10th to protest anti-queer religious rhetoric and abuse. According to a report in the Jerusalem Post, however, the heavily guarded demonstration was interrupted by a group of anarchists who joined the gathering and began waving placards against the war in Lebanon and shouting slogans against the Israeli Defense Force. Police detained one protester who unfurled a PLO flag. Because the vigil had no formal speakers and did not obstruct traffic, it was an otherwise legal gathering under Israeli law. The long-planned World Pride parade scheduled for that day was canceled after police refused to issue a permit, and organizers acknowledged that it would not be wise to hold the march because of current conflicts in the region. A huge red banner at the vigil read, "Jerusalem is for all," while rainbow-colored placards included such slogans as, "The path to God is not always straight." Reporting for This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon.
Kia ora, I'm Chris Carter. Being the first openly gay government minister in New Zealand is a great privilege. Almost as great as being able to listen to a quality queer radio program like This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine.
Pulitzer-nominated author Tom Spanbauer is most widely known for his epic novel, The Man Who Fell in Love with the Moon. His latest work is the autobiographical story of a gay teenager growing up in a bigoted Idaho farming town in the 1960s. This Way Out's Brian Goebel caught up with Spanbauer on the San Francisco leg of the book tour for Now is the Hour.
Parmesan cheese. My troubles all started with Parmesan cheese, and they ended with Parmesan cheese. My life up to now has been one big cheese cycle.
The universe has always conspired to screw up Rigby John Klusner, the lovable gay teenage protagonist in Tom Spanbauer's warm coming-of-age tale, Now is the Hour.
After 17 years of breathing, I, Rigby John Klusner, do hereby declare there sure as hell are a few people I could live without.
Like his cult classic, The Man Who Fell in Love with the Moon, Now is the Hour is about finding yourself, and it's loosely based on Spanbauer's own life in Pocatello, Idaho, which gets an apology in the acknowledgments. Young Rigby John struggles at home with his virulently religious family while trying to escape the violent attacks of Scardino the bully at school. He's also having an awakening about his sexuality in a small-minded town full of bigotry and homophobia. The characters in Now is the Hour are illuminated by Spanbauer's minimalist writing style, which involves the destruction of sentences, or as the author puts it, saying it wrong. Our protagonist begins the story right after his emancipation, when he's decided to stop being scared.
He's on Highway 93, somewhere between Reno and San Francisco, hitchhiking to San Francisco, and he's headed for the Summer of Love, but he doesn't know that yet. And the reason why he's out there really is because he's left his overly zealous Catholic mother and his laconic, kind of grumpy old father, and the small mores of the town of Pocatello, and he's leaving it all behind because really he's grown out of it. The story really, the profound story starts the day he's caught masturbating behind the barn, and his mother decides that for his soul, they have to do a novena to our Mother of Perpetual Help. It was about 5 o'clock. My chores were done and the sun was still up. I was leaning up against the barn in the sun, my bare ass against the warm red wood of the barn. I was slowly pulling on myself, feeling the deep grace of the earth and manure I was standing on coming up through me. I was just about ready. My breath was coming hard, when out of the blue the latch on the barn door turned. Then the squeak of the hinges of the old back door. Then the door was open, and there she was standing right there next to me in her red house dress, her plucked eyebrows, her pin curls and hairnet, the little lines around her starting around her mouth. Her almond-shaped hazel eyes looking down at me, down there, red and wet and poking up. My mother. Faster than you could say, mortal sin, Mom had closed the barn door. And there I stood with my pants down around my ankles, leaning up against the barn, gripping one long strand of mud down onto the dry cow manure. Just me and Tramp and the trap door to the underworld flung open inside my heart. I couldn't move. Really, I'm not exaggerating. I just fell over. Didn't try and catch myself for nothing. Just like a Roadrunner cartoon. One moment I was in one position standing up. The next I was in the same position lying down. The time between when Mom caught me and supper at 6 o'clock was an eternity. Everybody says eternity like it's just another word. But that day, that hour was an eternity. Something that was never going to end. And I didn't want it to end because the end meant I had to walk in the house and stand inside my mother's almond-shaped hazel eyes. All I wanted to do was smoke and smoke and smoke, but Dad's cigarettes were in the house, on the refrigerator. Plus, he would miss the cigarettes if I took more than one. Tramp, I said. Tramp, we're in big trouble. Tramp's orange face on his black dog face, his tongue went to hanging out. Tramp, I said, what am I going to do? Tramp got that look in his eyes. What the hell am I going to do? Tramp's paw went up, poking the air. I should have started hitchhiking right then, but I wasn't ready yet. It took almost 3 more years before I was ready for the road.
If you come to San Francisco,
Tom Spanbauer, so much of Now is the Hour is about being bullied. Were you picked on when you were a kid growing up in Idaho?
Boy, I sure was. I really was. Of course, there's my family. There was my father. There was the Catholic Church. And then I'd get on the bus to go 12 miles into town to the Catholic school. And there was all the Mormons and all the Indian kids on the bus. And I had to fight my way to school, and then I get to school, and there was Scardino, somebody like Scardino at St. Joe's, and hated me because you know, I was kind of, you know, it was before there were nerds. I guess I was just a big nerd then, you know, and, but, you know, kids now at least have the comfort of having a name they can call themselves. I didn't even know what I was. And so I ran into a lot of, pretty much I could say that my, from 7 to 12 was, you know, pretty horrible time. Of course, isn't it for every person almost with their, in their teen years, we're trying to form who we are and don't have a clue.
Your previous novel, The City of Shy Hunters, took you 10 years to write. How long did Now is the Hour take for you?
Well, I didn't want to have the bad reputation of taking 10 years to do a book, so I tried to turn it around as fast as I could. After Shy Hunters, I really didn't know if I could write again. That book was just about killed me. And it's taken me 4 years, just a little over 4 years to do this book, and I'm really happy to be here to tell you about that.
The characters that you write about are so lovable, but their stories are so sad. What does it take in you to build, to write the kind of characters in a story like Now is the Hour?
Well, you know, I think you look at the human condition very closely, and we're all really bewildered and confused. We're set down here on this earth, and we don't know which way to go. We don't know what to do. We don't know where to go next. And bewilderment is the human condition, which I think can bring out a lot of anger. And really, I think underneath it all, there's a lot of sadness. So all I think I'm really doing is touching into my own sadness, which is everybody's. I think it was the Dalai Lama who said that when you meet someone, you look closely into their eyes and be kind, because within those eyes, a great battle is waging. And I think that's kind of the human, what's happening with all of us. And so I just go to that place inside of me and try to put that on the page.
Thomas Bambauer, thank you.
Thank you. Wonderful being here.
Thomas Bambauer's new book is called Now is the Hour. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. For This Way Out, I'm Brian Goebel in San Francisco.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, John Beaupre, Tanya Kane Perry, Rex Walkner, Bill Kelly, Graham Underhill, and Brian Goebel contributed program material. Metropolitan Klezmer, Scott McKenzie, and Jimi Hendrix performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen online to This Way Out exclusively at outinamerica.com. Click on the features link on their front page, or use the link at the top of our website, thiswayout.org. Most This Way Out operating expenses are funded by direct charitable donations from our listeners. We thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can help keep this program on the air and choose from some special LGBT movie, music, and history CD thank you gifts. To sign up for our weekly emailed program information messages and or our occasional This Way Out updates, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We all thank you for listening on KMUN, Astoria, Oregon, WRUW, Cleveland, Ohio, CFRU, Guelph, Ontario, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Do stay tuned.